by implying that he was engaged in atrocious experiments on human subjects, the investigating officer wrote in his report. Schreiber's full statement was forwarded to Air Force headquarters. The security officers at Randolph Air Force Base did not have the kind of clearance that allowed them to access Dr. Schreiber's JOA file or his OMGUS security report. They had no idea who Schreiber really was. They most certainly had not been made aware that he was a Nazi ideologue and the former Surgeon General of the Third Reich. All anyone at the School of Aviation Medicine would have known was that he was a German scientist who was part of Operation Paperclip. The facility had already employed 34 German scientists. On December 14th, the FBI got involved in the case. Dr. Leopold Alexander, Schreiber's accuser in Boston, was an internationally renowned authority on medical crimes. His allegations had to be taken seriously. But the Air Force was unwilling to give up Dr. Schreiber right away. To garner support for him, a memo, classified secret, was circulated among those involved, heralding the professional and personal qualifications of Dr. Walter Schreiber. The memo stated, "He possesses an analytical mind, critical judgment, objectivity, and a wealth of well-detailed, exact information. Schreiber possessed know-how on preventative health measures, military and civilian, under conditions of total war. He had detailed information of medical problems in connection with desert and Arctic warfare, and he had contributed to Zeiss Atlas of epidemiology. He'd been a key prisoner of war in Russia for 3.5 years, and he is in a position to provide authoritative information and serve as a consultant on vitally important medical matters in Russia." With public outrage brewing over the Globe article, the situation escalated quickly. The Pentagon became involved, and the matter was sent to the Office of the Surgeon General of the United States Air Force. That position was now held by none other than Harry Armstrong, recently promoted to Major General. Armstrong knew the situation could very quickly get out of control. And hardly anyone had more to lose, personally and professionally, than he did. With the assistance of Dr. Hubertus Strughold, Harry Armstrong had personally recruited 58 former Nazi doctors for work at the U.S. Army Air Force's Aeromedical Center in Heidelberg, 5 of whom had been arrested for war crimes, 4 of whom were tried at Nuremberg, 2 of whom were convicted at Nuremberg, and 1 of whom was acquitted and then rehired by the U.S. Air Force to work in America before being revealed as incompetent and fired. That said nothing of the 34 doctors who had since been hired to work at the School of Aviation Medicine, many of whom were Nazi ideologues, as well as former members of the SS and the SA. The Schreiber scandal could trigger a domino effect, shining an unwanted spotlight on the highly suspicious backgrounds of Dr. Strughold, Dr. Benzinger, Dr. Conrad Schaffer, Dr. Becker Freising, Dr. Schroeder, Dr. Roof, and so many others. Major General Harry Armstrong wrote to the Director of Intelligence of the Air Force regarding Major General Dr. Schreiber. "I have been advised by the Commandant, U.S. Air Force School of Aviation Medicine, Randolph Air Force Base, Texas, that they recently forwarded to your office a request for a new contract for Dr. Walter Schreiber until June 1952, Armstrong wrote. Recent information indicated that Dr. Schreiber may have been implicated in the medical war crimes in Germany during World War II, and his presence in this country has aroused a considerable amount of criticism. As a consequence of this, it is the firm opinion of this office that the Air Force Medical Service cannot associate itself with Dr. Schreiber beyond the 6 months contract under which he is now employed. Further," said Armstrong, "it may be advisable to terminate this contract even prior to its expiration." Armstrong promised that the commandant of the School of Aviation Medicine, Major General Otis Benson, concurs with this recommendation. General Benson had equal reason to want the Schreiber scandal to quietly disappear. After the war, Benson had served as technical supervisor of the German scientists working at the Army Air Force's Aeromedical Center in Heidelberg. 2 weeks after the scandal broke, Dr. Schreiber was informed that his contract would not be renewed. General Benson delivered the news in person. According to Schreiber, Benson also proposed a secret alternative plan involving Schreiber's future career in America. In an affidavit, Schreiber swore that General Benson stated that he felt sure my services could be utilized in other branches of the government or in medical schools, and offered his assistance in soliciting for a position for me. In Boston, the matter continued to generate press. The Yanina Iwanska story was news people were interested in reading about. Despite what had been done to her during the war, Yanina Iwanska was a vibrant, beautiful, credible young woman. It was almost impossible not to marvel at her resilience. After being liberated from Ravensbrück, she had moved to Paris, where she had been working as a journalist for Radio Free Europe. She also worked as the Paris-based correspondent for several Polish newspapers in Western Europe. When Iwanska was experimented on at Ravensbrück, she was only 17 years old. While imprisoned there, she and several other female prisoners had taken remarkable steps to get word outside the camp about what was being done by Nazi doctors at Ravensbrück, with the goal of getting their message to the Vatican, the BBC, and the International Red Cross. Iwanska and four other women sent secret messages to their relatives outside the camp. Remarkably, a French prisoner named Germaine Tillion took photographs of the women's wounds, then smuggled a roll of film out of the camp. The story was printed in the Polish underground press during the war, notifying the world about the Ravensbrück medical experiments. The story was eventually picked up by the BBC, as the women had hoped. Now, with the Schreiber story gaining momentum, in January 1951, FBI agents arranged to interview Yanina Iwanska in Boston. Under oath, and from a photograph, she identified Dr. Schreiber as a high-ranking doctor who had overseen the medical experiments at Ravensbrück. How do you know the Dr. Schreiber, whom you saw in the concentration camp in Germany in 1942 and 1943, is the same Dr. Walter Schreiber who is now in San Antonio? An FBI agent asked her. 3 weeks ago, the journalist was coming from the Boston Post, and they showed me about 50 pictures, and they asked me if I know which one is Dr. Schreiber, Iwanska said. She described how she had no trouble picking Schreiber's photograph out of 50 presented to her. I saw this face in the doctor's group at Ravensbrück, she said. After, they asked me if I knew Schreiber's name. I told them, I know Schreiber's name. Dr. Schreiber, in a separate interview, claimed that he had had nothing to do with the Ravensbrück experiments, that he had never even visited a concentration camp, and that he had never met Yanina Iwanska, who was accusing him of outrageous acts. In response, Yanina Iwanska had this to say, I had an operation done on my legs by Dr. Gebhardt. During the first dressing after the operations, I spoke to him. I asked Dr. Gebhardt why they did the operation, and they gave me the answer, we can do the experiment because you are condemned to die. The number tattooed on my legs are TKM3. If Dr. Schreiber cannot remember my name, I am sure, perhaps, he can remember the experiment number. Yanina Iwanska said she was sure that Dr. Schreiber was at the concentration camp. She had seen him with her own eyes. After operations were performed on 74 women, she explained, there was a doctor's conference at the concentration camp. Were you present at the doctor's conference? The FBI agent asked. Yes, because every woman who had the experiment was taken in the conference room, and Gebhardt explained to the other doctors what he did. Do you remember the date of this conference by Dr. Gebhardt and Dr. Schreiber about your experiment? I think it was about 3 weeks after the operation of 15th of August 1942, Yanina Iwanska said. Did any of the people who were experimented on die as a result of the experiments? Yes, 5 died 48 hours after the operation, and 6 were shot after the operation, Iwanska said. Do you know the names of those who died as a result of the operation? I have the list at my house. I sent the names to the United Nations. They have all the documents. It was 74 who had the experiment. Do you have any knowledge as to whether Dr. Schreiber ordered these experiments done? I don't know if he gave the orders. Only I know he was very interested in it, she said. Back in Texas, Dr. Schreiber began plotting his escape to Argentina. He wrote to his married daughter, Elizabeth Vanderfecht, who was living in San Ysidro in Buenos Aires. He asked her to get information about how he could get a visa fast. The FBI intercepted Schreiber's mail. I will be able to get a visa for you all within 14 days, promised Schreiber's daughter. To be honest, we have always feared something similar to come. Everything started so well and seemed to be wonderful. Your nice house, your new furniture. She assured her father that she could help get the paperwork necessary to enter Argentina. If, father, you wish us to take steps, send us the necessary documents, Elizabeth wrote. Anyhow, the risk would be much less than if you must go to Germany. For heaven's sake, do not go back. By mid-January, the JOA weighed in. The Joint Chiefs decided that it was necessary to repatriate Dr. Schreiber. Reason for requesting repatriation? Dr. Schreiber is basically not a research scientist, and as such, his usefulness is very limited to the School of Aviation Medicine, a memo read. Recent criticism and adverse publicity have been directed against the School of Aviation Medicine in that it has been charged that Dr. Schreiber, as a high-ranking Nazi medical officer, was connected with brutal experiments on concentration camp victims. The School of Aviation Medicine and the Surgeon General do not wish to assume responsibility for Schreiber in view of the above criticism. Army headquarters in Heidelberg, Germany, disagreed. On February 5, 1952, the Army cabled a message marked secret to JOA written in shorthand. Recommend take action to retain Schreiber in U.S. Subject has invaluable info of intelligence nature regarding Russia and is outstanding in his professional field. The office of the U.S. High Commissioner weighed in. All reparations of paperclip personnel unless voluntary have some adverse effect on JOA programs, a memo stated. Request coordinate with G2 Army prior to final decision on repatriation. At Air Force headquarters, another idea was gaining support. Why not help Dr. Schreiber move to Argentina? To this end, a major named D.A. Rowe from Army Intelligence G2 contacted Argentinian General Aristobulo Fidel Reyes to discuss the utilization of the services of Dr. Walter Paul Schreiber, M.D. Major Rowe queried if, in any way possible, his talents could be used in Argentina. The Army had originally intended to allow the talented Dr. Schreiber to immigrate to the United States, Major Rowe explained. But, unfortunately, that had changed. His admissibility, under current law, as an immigrant of the U.S. is questionable because of his close affiliation with the Nazi Army, Major Rowe clarified. Argentina did not have the same kinds of immigration laws prohibiting entry of former high-ranking Nazis. it would be great if they could help. Faced with pushback from High Commissioner John J. McCloy, JOA retooled its repatriation position and instead made a case for extending Dr. Schreiber's stay. Schreiber family may be subjected to reprisals due to his previously reported escape from Russian control, JOA wrote. If repatriation is inadvisable, believe Schreiber may be retained here by issuance of visa. Above is additional reason for desirability of entry with immigration visa. But then a new document emerged, marked JOA Eyes Only, and to be kept in Schreiber's classified dossier. Schreiber's wife of 40 years, Olga, was also an old-time Nazi. According to official NSDAP paperwork, she had joined the Nazi Party on October 1, 1931, years before Hitler came to power. Each week that passed brought more focus to the subject. The public was growing increasingly outraged with the notion that an ex-Nazi general, an alleged war criminal, was still living in the United States, and that his employment by the United States Air Force was still up in the air. The Physicians Forum, a group of doctors representing 36 states, wrote to the Senate. Had Dr. Schreiber been found and apprehended at the time of the Nuremberg Military Tribunal, the doctors wrote, it is virtually certain that he would have been brought to trial along with his associates, many of whom were sentenced to life imprisonment or hanged for their crimes. Instead, this individual is now in the United States working for our Air Force. The physicians unanimously recommended immediate expulsion of Dr. Schreiber from the United States and a thorough investigation of the circumstances leading to Dr. Schreiber's entry into this country and his assignment to the Air Force. The final demand was far more threatening to the Air Force than the Physicians Forum doctors could have known. Were the Senate to hold hearings to investigate similar appointments of German physicians, formerly in important positions in the German armed forces during World War II, the whole paperclip program could be revealed. Heads would roll. Schreiber's story could travel all the way up to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the scandal, all the way to the President of the United States. With an astonishing degree of hubris, Dr. Schreiber gave one media interview after the next, professing innocence and calling all the charges against him lies. I am not fighting for a renewal of my contract, Schreiber told the Washington Post. I am fighting for justice, and I will continue to do so as long as I live. He issued an egregiously false statement declaring, I was never a member of the staff of the Supreme Command of the Wehrmacht. In another interview, he said, I never worked in a concentration camp. Later in the interview, he clarified that he had actually visited a camp once in eastern Pomerania without knowing it was a concentration camp. His very brief job there was to inspect a report for the delousing treatment for a group of girls whose linen was disinfected with DDT, Schreiber said. After I arrived there, 4 days later, the girls were found clean and free of lice, Schreiber said. Dr. Schreiber had the Air Force and the Joint Chiefs of Staff over a barrel, and he likely knew it. If any one of these high-ranking U.S. government officials was forced to admit what was really known about Schreiber and what had been known all along, it would be a scandal of the first degree. Instead, the lie was allowed to expand. Until we come up with some basic facts, JOA Director Colonel Benjamin W. Heckmeyer told Time magazine in an exclusive sit-down interview with a reporter named Miss Moran, a man should be given the all-American treatment here and not be given the bum's rush. Behind the scenes, Harry Armstrong, Surgeon General of the Air Force, had been spearheading Schreiber's removal. But in statements to the press, he maintained a facade of support. There is no evidence he's guilty other than serving his country during war, same as I did mine, General Armstrong told the Associated Press. Legendary newspaper columnist Drew Pearson did not see things in the same light. He pulled transcripts from the Nuremberg doctor's trial and quoted from them in Washington Merry-Go-Round. Here are the facts regarding the Nazi doctor who escaped the Nuremberg war crimes trial and is now working for the Air Force at Randolph Field, Texas, Pearson wrote. Kicking, screaming young Polish girls were held down by SS troops and forcibly operated on. Nuremberg document number 619 also shows that Schreiber was second on a list of prominent medical officers detached to the SS for 2 days. Human victims were also used in typhus experiments at Buchenwald and Natzweiler concentration camps. Deadly virus was transferred from men to mice and back in an attempt to produce live vaccine. Schreiber responded by saying, "The Nuremberg Military Tribunal has prosecuted and held those responsible for the crimes." That statement further incensed Dr. Leo Alexander and Boston attorney Alexander Hardy, the former chief prosecutor at the doctor's trial. The two men drafted a 10-page letter to President Truman. "He was not a defendant, but beyond a doubt, he is responsible for medical crimes," Hardy and Alexander explained. "He certainly had full knowledge that concentration camp inmates were being systematically experimented on by doctors of the medical service in which he was a general. Schreiber's subordinates performed experiments encouraged by Schreiber, who in turn made materials and funds available and the holding of conferences." Hardy and Alexander cited testimony from 5 of Schreiber's physician colleagues who testified at the Nuremberg doctor's trial that Schreiber had overseen a host of hygiene-related Reich medical programs in which countless humans were sacrificed in the name of research. Included were details of yellow fever experiments, epidemic jaundice experiments, sulfanilamide experiments, euthanasia by phenol experiments, and the notorious typhus vaccine program with its 90% death rate. Alexander Hardy and Dr. Alexander's letter to President Truman portrayed Major General Dr. Walter Schreiber not only as a war criminal of the worst order, but as a sadist and a liar. Parts of the letter were made public. "Truman is urged to expel physician," read a headline in the New York Times. Harry Armstrong wrote to the Physicians Forum, assuring them that Schreiber would be returned to Germany at once. JOA Director Colonel Heckmeyer was asked by Time magazine what the Air Force was going to do if, after completing its investigation, it found Dr. Schreiber guilty of war crimes. "That I will have to get guidance from the Office of the Secretary of Defense on," Heckmeyer said. "Could Schreiber be prosecuted?" the Time reporter asked. "We are not going to make a Nuremberg trial 3 years after the trials are closed," Heckmeyer said. Finally, the Secretary of the Air Force, Thomas Finletter, made a public announcement stating that Dr. Schreiber would be dropped from his contract and put under military custody. He would leave the United States at once. But Dr. Schreiber refused to leave the United States. Instead, he packed up his family, left Texas, and drove to San Francisco. There, the Schreibers moved in with Dorothea, the couple's married daughter, and her husband, William Fry, in their home at 35 Ridge Road in San Anselmo. Just as Dorothea had worked at Camp King when her father was post-surgeon there, her new husband, William Fry, had served at Camp King as an Army intelligence investigator. Having moved to America in July 1951, the two had lived in California since. More than a month passed. The Physicians Forum received new information about Schreiber, which they submitted to President Truman on April 24, 1952, along with a telegram marked urgent. They attached a document that showed that Brigadier General Otis Benson, commanding general at Randolph Field School of Aviation Medicine, sought continued employment for Dr. Schreiber in the United States preferably a university appointment, after the Air Force had already promised that Schreiber would soon be leaving the United States. The outrageous part, said the physicians, was that the U.S. Air Force was colluding to keep Schreiber in the United States. In their letter to President Truman, they quoted General Benson from a letter he'd written to the dean of the Minnesota School of Public Health, seeking a new job for Schreiber in the private sector. "I like and respect the man, but he is too hot for me to keep here using public funds," General Benson said of Schreiber. He said that the bad press had been little more than an organized medical movement against him, emanating from Boston by medical men of Jewish ancestry. The Physicians Forum's board of directors demanded that President Truman order the Attorney General to open an investigation into the case. A few days later, a lieutenant colonel named G.A. Little, representing the Joint Chiefs of Staff, flew to California to visit with Dr. Schreiber at his daughter's house for the purpose of attempting to persuade Dr. Schreiber to go to Buenos Aires at once, regardless of job opportunities which might or might not be developed through our office. According to Little, the visit went well. "We were very cordially received by Dr. Schreiber and spent approximately 2 hours in conversation with him," Lieutenant Colonel G.A. Little wrote in a confidential report for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In exchange for transportation to South America and funds for travel and travel allowance for Schreiber family group, Dr. Schreiber agreed to leave the United States at once. Schreiber's voluntary and immediate departure for Buenos Aires will provide a satisfactory solution for all concerned. The amount Schreiber was paid to leave was never disclosed and is not mentioned in his declassified Operation Paperclip file. On May 22, 1952, Dr. Schreiber and his family were flown by military aircraft from Travis Air Force Base in California to New Orleans, Louisiana. There, they boarded a ship bound for Argentina. When they arrived in Buenos Aires, they were taken by car to the American consulate and given documents that allowed them to stay. The arrangements were made by General Aristobulo Fidel Reyes. The Air Force paid for police protection for Dr. Schreiber and his family during the transition. It was important that the Schreiber's resettlement in South America go smoothly. There were too many American officials whose reputations would never survive if the facts were revealed. The Senate hearings never happened, and the Attorney General never opened a case. In Argentina, Dr. Schreiber bought a home and named it Sans Souci, without a care, the name of the summer palace in Potsdam outside Berlin of Frederick the Great, King of Prussia. According to personal family documents, Schreiber's final quest was to prove that he had been born a baron and was descended from Prussian royalty. As a consequence of what the official investigation turned up, in addition to his own extraordinary, meritorious achievements, say the family documents, Oberstabsarzt, military medical doctor, Walter P. Schreiber, was given official permission to add Vaughn to his name. The personal papers did not say who gave this official permission. Schreiber died in September 1970 in San Carlos de Bariloche, Rio Negro, Argentina. Chapter 19, Truth Serum. As Dr. Schreiber sailed for Argentina, the Operation Bluebird interrogation program at Camp King expanded to include the use of drugs and chemicals in unconventional interrogation. Dr. Kurt Bloma was Camp King's post-doctor during this period. According to a memo in his declassified foreign scientist case file, Bloma worked on Army 1952 Project 1975, a top-secret project that itself has never been declassified. Bloma's file becomes empty after that. Bluebird was rechristened Artichoke, writes John Marks, a former State Department official and authority on the CIA's mind control programs. The goal of the Artichoke interrogation program, Marks explains, was modifying behavior through covert means. According to the program's administrator, Richard Helms, the future director of the CIA, using drugs was a means to that end. We felt that it was our responsibility not to lag behind the Russians or the Chinese in this field, and the only way to find out what the risks were was to test things such as LSD and other drugs that could be used to control human behavior, Helms told journalist David Frost in an interview in 1978. Other U.S. intelligence agencies were brought on board to help conduct these controversial interrogation experiments. In 1951, the CIA director approved the liaison with Army, Navy, and Air Force intelligence to avoid duplication of effort, writes Marks. The Army and Navy were both looking for truth drugs, while the prime concern of the Air Force was interrogation techniques used on downed pilots. Since the end of the war, the various U.S. military branches had developed advanced air, land, and sea rescue programs, based in part on research conducted by Nazi doctors. But the Soviets had also made great advances in rescue programs, and this presented a serious new concern. If a downed U.S. pilot or soldier was rescued by the Russians, that person would almost certainly be subjected to unconventional interrogation techniques, according to the CIA. The purpose of Operation Bluebird was to try to predict what kinds of methods the Soviets might use against American soldiers and airmen. One of the so-called truth serum drugs the CIA believed the Soviets were most heavily involved in researching was LSD. One CIA report, later shared with Congress, stated that the Soviets purchased a large quantity of LSD-25 from the Sandoz company, reputed to be sufficient for 50 million doses, or so the CIA thought. A later analysis of the information determined that the CIA analyst working on the report made a decimal point error while performing dosage calculations. The Soviets had in fact purchased enough LSD from Sandoz for a few thousand tests, a far cry from 50 million. For its Operation Bluebird experiments involving LSD and other drugs, the CIA teamed up with the Army Chemical Corps. The initial research and development was conducted by officers with the Special Operations Division, who worked inside a classified facility designated Building Number 439, a one-story, concrete block building set among similar-looking buildings at Camp Dietrich, so as to blend in. Almost no one outside the SO division knew about the top-secret work going on inside. The SO division was paid for by the CIA's Technical Services Staff, TSS, a unit within the CIA's clandestine service. Many of its field agents were culled from a pool of senior bacteriologists at Dietrich. One of these SO division field agents was Dr. Harold Batchelor, the man behind the eight ball, who consulted with Dr. Kurt Blomma in Heidelberg in 1947. Another SO division agent was Dr. Frank Olson, a former Army officer and bacteriologist turned agency operative whose sudden demise in 1953 would nearly bring down the CIA. The two men were assigned to the program at Camp King, involving unconventional interrogation techniques. In April 1950, Frank Olson was issued a diplomatic passport. Olson was not a diplomat. The passport allowed him to carry items in a diplomatic pouch that would not be subject to searches by customs officials. Frank Olson began taking trips to Germany, flying to Frankfurt and making the short drive out to Camp King. In one of the rare surviving official documents from the program, Deputy Director of Central Intelligence, Alan Dulles, sent a secret memo to Richard Helms and CIA Deputy Director for Plans, Frank Wisner, regarding the specific kinds of interrogation techniques that would be used. In our conversation of 9 February 1951, I outlined to you the possibilities of augmenting the usual interrogation methods by the use of drugs, hypnosis, shock, etc., and emphasized the defensive aspects as well as the offensive opportunities in this field of applied medical science, wrote Dulles. The enclosed folder, Interrogation Techniques, was prepared in my medical division to provide you with a suitable background. Camp King was the perfect location to conduct these trials. Overseas locations were preferred for artichoke interrogations, since foreign governments permitted certain activities which were not permitted by the United States government, i.e. anthrax, etc. The next trip on record made by Frank Olson occurred on June 12, 1952. Olson arrived at Frankfurt from the Hendon Military Airport in England and made the short drive west into Oberursel. There, artichoke interrogation experiments were taking place in a safe house called House Waldorf. Between 4 June 1952 and 18 June 1952, an ISNO, CIA Inspection and Security Office, team applied artichoke techniques to two operational cases in a safe house, explains an artichoke memorandum written for CIA Director Dulles, and one of the few action memos on record not destroyed by Richard Helms when he was CIA director. The two individuals being interrogated at the Camp King safe house could be classed as experienced, professional-type agents and suspected of working for Soviet intelligence. These were Soviet spies captured by the Galen organization, now being run by the CIA. In the first case, light dosages of drugs coupled with hypnosis were used to induce a complete hypnotic trance, the memo reveals. This trance was held for approximately 1 hour and 40 minutes of interrogation, with a subsequent total amnesia produced. The plan was straightforward. Drug the spies, interrogate the spies, and give them amnesia to make them forget. Another surviving memo from this otherwise unreported chapter of Cold War history is from Dr. Henry Knowles Beecher, chief anesthetist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston and a CIA Army Navy advisor on artichoke techniques. Beecher traveled to Germany to observe what was happening at Camp King. He was a colleague of Dr. Leopold Alexander's in Boston and, like Alexander, was an outspoken advocate of the Nuremberg Code, the first principle of which is informed consent. And yet, in one of the stranger Cold War cases of dissimulation, Dr. Beecher was a participant in secret government-sponsored medical experiments that did not involve consent. Beecher was paid by the CIA and the Navy to consult on how best to produce amnesia in Soviet spies after they were drugged and interrogated, so they would forget what had been done to them. Dr. Frank Olson returned from Germany to his office in Dietrich in a moral bind, according to his Dietrich colleague, the bacteriologist Norman Kurneuer. He had a tough time after Germany. Drugs, torture, brainwashing, Kurneuer explained decades later for a documentary for German television made in 2001. Kurneuer said that Olson felt ashamed about what he had witnessed, and that the experiments at Camp King reminded him of what had been done to people in concentration camps. Back in America, Olson contemplated leaving his job. He told family members he was considering a new career as a dentist. Instead, he stayed on at the bioweapons facility, becoming chief of the SO division for a while. He continued to work on top-secret biological and chemical weapons programs in the CIA's office at Dietrich, building number 439. Unknown to Frank Olson, the CIA was expanding its artichoke program in new ways, including expanding its use of LSD in unconventional interrogations through covert means. Strapping a suspected Soviet spy to a chair and dosing him with drugs, as was done at Camp King's House Waldorf, was one approach to getting a spy to spill his secrets. But the CIA wondered what would happen if an enemy agent were to be given an incapacitating agent like LSD on the sly without knowing he'd been drugged. Would this kind of amnesia be effective? Could it produce loyalty? How much, if any, of the experience would be remembered? These were questions the CIA wanted answered. The director of the technical services staff, Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, a stutterer with a club foot, decided that the first field tests should be conducted on men from the SO division without them knowing about it. One of those targeted for experimentation was Dr. Frank Olson. A week before Thanksgiving, in November 1953, six SO division agents, including Frank Olson and the new SO division chief, Vincent Rouette, were invited to a weekend retreat at a CIA safe house in western Maryland called Deep Creek Lake. There, the men from Dietrich were met by TSS Director Sidney Gottlieb and his deputy, Robert Lashbrook, a chemist. One part of the agenda was to discuss the latest covert means of poisoning people with biological agents and toxic substances, including those that had been acquired from around the globe by Fritz Hoffmann, the Operation Paperclip scientist with the Chemical Corps. The second goal was to covertly dose the six SO division men with LSD and record what happened. After dinner on the second night, Robert Lashbrook secretly added LSD to a bottle of Cointreau. The unwitting test subjects were all offered a drink, and all but two of the SO division officers drank the aperitif. One had a heart condition, and the other abstained from alcohol. Frank Olson had a terrible reaction to having been drugged with LSD. He became psychologically unstable and could not sleep. His boss, Vincent Rouette, who had also been dosed, described his own LSD poisoning experience as the most frightening experience I ever had or hope to have. The CIA had at least one of their questions answered now. Covert LSD poisoning did not produce amnesia. When Monday morning came around, Rouette arrived for work at 7:30 as usual. Inside Dietrich's building number 439, he found a very agitated Dr. Frank Olson waiting for him. Olson told Rouette that he was devastated by what had happened at Deep Creek Lake. He wanted to quit or be fired. Rouette told him to give the issue some time and to get back to work. But when Rouette arrived for work the following morning at 7:30, he again found Frank Olson waiting for him. Olson's mental state had deteriorated considerably, and Rouette decided that he needed medical help. He called agency headquarters in Washington, D.C., and told Robert Lashbrook what was going on. Frank Olson was privy to the CIA's most controversial behavior modification and mind control programs. If he had a psychotic break in public, he could inadvertently talk, terribly ironic, since getting a man to spill his secrets was what this LSD poisoning program was all about. Were Frank Olson to talk, the agency would have a nightmare on its hands. Dr. Olson was in serious trouble and needed immediate professional attention, Lashbrook wrote in an after-incident CIA report. Lashbrook told Vincent Rouette to bring Olson to headquarters immediately. From there, the two men took Olson to a townhouse in New York City, at 133 East 58th Street. There, Olson met with a doctor on the CIA's payroll named Harold Abramson. Abramson was not a psychiatrist. He was an allergist and immunologist who worked on LSD tolerance experiments for the CIA, and he carried a secret clearance of his own. Frank Olson told Dr. Abramson that he was suffering from memory loss, confusion, feelings of inadequacy, and terrible guilt. Dr. Abramson noted that Olson seemed to have a perfectly good memory and could remember people, places, and events easily on demand. In other words, Frank Olson's problems were all in his mind. The next morning, Robert Lashbrook and Vincent Rouette took Frank Olson on another visit to another CIA contract employee, John Mulholland, a semi-famous New York City magician. Like Dr. Abramson, magician John Mulholland had a secret security clearance with the TSS. Mulholland taught CIA agents how to apply the magician's art to covert activities. One of his specialties was the delivery of various materials to unwitting subjects. During the visit, Olson became suspicious of what was going on and asked to leave. By the next day, Frank Olson was hearing voices. He told Dr. Abramson that the CIA was trying to poison him, which they already had done at least once. Vincent Rouette returned to Maryland to be with his family for Thanksgiving. Abramson and Lashbrook decided to have Frank Olson committed to the Chestnut Lodge Sanitarium in Rockville, Maryland. Conveniently, the CIA had doctors on staff there. Robert Lashbrook and Frank Olson spent one last night in New York City in the Statler Hotel on 7th Avenue and 33rd Street. They were given room 1018A on the 10th floor. After eating in the hotel restaurant, Olson and Lashbrook returned to their room to have a drink and watch television. Olson called his wife for the first time since he had left home and told her not to worry, that he'd be home soon. Then he went to sleep. At approximately 2:30 a.m., Olson crashed through the hotel window and fell more than 100 feet to his death on the street below. According to the coroner's report, Olson hit the ground feet first, as if standing up, fell backward, and broke his skull. The Statler Hotel night manager, Armand Pastore, heard the impact and ran outside. He found Olson lying on the pavement, still alive. His eyes were open, Pastore told the police, and he tried to say something, but no words came out, and after a few moments, Frank Olson took his last breath. Pastore looked up to see which room Olson had come out of. He could see that one of the window shades in a room high above was sticking out, as if the shade had been down when Olson crashed through it. Pastore noted which room it might be. When the police arrived, he took them up to the 10th floor and into room 1018A, using the manager's pass key to get inside. There, inside the bathroom, CIA agent Robert Lashbrook sat on the toilet seat in his underwear, holding his head in his hands. Lashbrook had already made two telephone calls. The first call was to the CIA's Director of the Technical Services Staff, Sidney Gottlieb, the man who had, with Lashbrook, poisoned Frank Olson with LSD a little over a week before. The second call was to the hotel's front desk to report Olson's suicide. When New York City Police Detective James W. Ward arrived on the scene, he asked Robert Lashbrook several questions, to which Lashbrook responded using only the words yes and no. Lashbrook did not identify himself as a CIA agent. Dr. Lashbrook was taken in for questioning. Homicide had not yet been ruled out. At the precinct, Detective Ward asked Lashbrook to empty his pockets. Among the contents were papers with addresses for Dr. Harold Abramson in New York City and the Chestnut Lodge Sanitarium in Rockville, Maryland. When asked about his profession, Lashbrook told Detective Ward that he was a chemist with the War Department and that Frank Olson was a scientist at Camp Dietrich and that Olson was mentally ill. Detective Ward called Dr. Abramson, who verified Lashbrook's story, leaving out that he also worked for the CIA. 2 days later, Detective Ward submitted case number 125124 to his station chief. The death of Frank Olson was determined to be a suicide. The case was closed. If the Greek philosopher Heraclitus is right, and war is the father of all things, then America's Nazi scientist program was a nefarious child of the Second World War. Operation Paperclip, in turn, created a host of monstrous offspring, including Operations Bluebird, Artichoke, and MKUltra. Before Frank Olson became involved in the CIA's poisoning and interrogation programs, he conducted research and development of the airborne delivery of biological weapons. Olson had been working in the field of biological weapons research since 1943. He was recruited by Dietrich's first director, Ira Baldwin, during the war. After the war, Dr. Olson became a civilian scientist at Dietrich. He joined the Special Operations Division in 1950 and was part of a team that covertly tested how a weaponized biological agent might disperse if used against Americans. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, Olson had traveled across the United States, overseeing field tests that dispersed biological agents from aircraft and crop dusters in San Francisco, the Midwest, and Alaska. Some field tests involved harmless simulants, and others involved dangerous pathogens, as Senate hearings later revealed. One such dangerous experiment was conducted by Olson and his Dietrich colleague, Norman Kornheuer. The two men went to Alaska and oversaw bacteria being sprayed out of airplanes to see how the pathogens would disperse in an environment similar to that of a harsh Russian winter. "We used a spore," Kornheuer explained, "which is very similar to anthrax, so to that extent we did something that was not kosher, because we picked it up all over the United States months after we did the tests." A third man involved in the covert tests with Kornheuer and Olson was Dr. Harold Batchelor, the bacteriologist who learned airborne spray techniques from Dr. Kurt Bloma, whom Batchelor consulted with in Heidelberg. Olson and Batchelor also conducted covert field tests in closed spaces across America, including in subways and in the Pentagon. For these tests, the Special Operations Division used a relatively harmless pathogen that simulated how a deadly pathogen would disperse. A congressional inquiry into these covert tests found them appalling in their deception. By being part of a team of covert poisoners, be it out in the Alaskan tundra or inside a safe house at Camp King in Germany, Dr. Frank Olson and his colleagues violated the Nuremberg Code, which requires informed consent. As circumstances would have it, the great tragedy of Frank Olson's life and death was that his own inalienable right to be protected from harm from his government and his doctor was violated on orders from the very same people to whom he had dedicated his life's work. This new war, the Cold War, was now the father of its own dark events. Part 5. War is the father of all things. Heraclitus. Chapter 20. In the Dark Shadows. The Cold War became a battlefield marked by doublespeak. Disguise, distortion, and deception were accepted as reality. Truth was promised in a serum. An Operation Paperclip, born in the ashes of World War II, was the inciting incident in this hall of mirrors. But in 1952, the heedless momentum of Operation Paperclip began to slow, as conflicts emerged between the JOA and the CIA over policies with the new West German government. German officials warned High Commissioner John J. McCloy that Operation Paperclip violated NATO regulations and even America's own policies for governance in Germany. On February 21, 1952, McCloy sent a memo to the U.S. Secretary of State expressing his concern that if Paperclip was not curtailed, it could result in a violent reaction from officials in West Germany. With McCloy no longer expressing unbridled enthusiasm for Operation Paperclip, the JOA began to lose its once indomitable grip on the program. But the CIA was not bound to the same NATO policies as were the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and so the CIA continued to do what it had been doing, namely recruiting Nazi scientists and intelligence officers to act as advisors at Camp King. The five-year partnership between the two agencies began to unravel. JOA officials became furious as they watched the CIA poach German scientists and technicians from the accelerated paperclip lists. In response, and in spite of McCloy's requests otherwise, in the winter of 1952, the JOA prepared to send a 20-man team to Frankfurt on a recruiting trip. Delegates included JOA's new deputy director, Colonel Gerald Crabb, General Walter Dornberger, and five unnamed paperclip scientists who were already working in America. When McCloy learned of the trip, he asked the State Department to intervene and cancel it, fearing it would draw the ire of German officials, which it did. The trip happened anyway. A compromise was reached between U.S. officials and Chancellor Konrad Adenauer's office, whereby the JOA and the CIA agreed to stop recruiting new scientists, but could continue to work with the scientists who remained on the original, President Truman-approved 1,000-person list. Official numbers vary dramatically in different declassified record groups, but there were approximately 600 paperclip scientists in the United States at this time, meaning some 400 German scientists were still on the target list. JOA renamed Paperclip the Defense Scientists Immigration Program, or DEFSIP, and the CIA renamed one vein of its involvement the National Interest Program, but most parties still referred to it all as Operation Paperclip. It was a dwindling empire. In 1956, the CIA ceded control of the Gehlen Organization to the West German government, which renamed it the BND, Bundesnachrichtendienst. The former Nazi general and his men were spies for Chancellor Adenauer's government now. Then, in 1957, JOA got a new lieutenant officer in Lieutenant Colonel Henry Whalen, a man whose actions would have a profound effect on the legacy of the paperclip program. By 1959, Whalen was promoted to deputy director of JOA, which meant he had access to highly classified intelligence reports from scientists working on atomic, biological, and chemical weapons. Whalen had an office in the E-ring of the Pentagon, reserved for senior officials, and enjoyed direct access to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. During his year-long tenure as JOA deputy director, no one had any idea that Whalen was working as a Soviet spy. It wasn't until 1963 that the FBI learned that he had been passing military secrets to Colonel Sergei Idemsky, a GRU intelligence agent posing as a military attaché in the Soviet embassy in Washington. By then, Henry Whalen had already left the JOA. When the Justice Department began investigating Whalen, they seized all of the JOA records that he had been working with. The FBI learned that Whalen had destroyed or given away thousands of paperclip files. In 1966, a grand jury was presented with evidence against Whalen behind closed doors. He was indicted, and the trial was conducted under a gag order, with the press denied access to what the FBI had learned and to Whalen's confession. Journalists were prohibited from reporting on the trial, and no one made the connection between Whalen, the JOA, and Operation Paperclip. The Nazi scientist program had long since faded from public discourse. Whalen was sentenced to 15 years at a federal penitentiary, but was paroled after 6 years. most of the FBI's investigation of Whalen remains classified, which likely explains why so few paperclip files from that time frame